Okay. So the man is in the desert, and he rubs a bottle, and a genie comes out, and the genie is so pleased to be out of the bottle that he says, I will grant you any wish, within reason. And the man says, well, I'm stranded in the desert. I would really love to be back in Boston, Massachusetts, my home. And the genie says, okay, I'll walk with you there. And the man says, well, no, I meant I would like to get there fast, like poof. And the genie says, okay, let's do this, let's do this, let's run. Anyway, that's the whole joke. Okay, so I have managed to fall essentially a full lecture behind, entirely my own fault, but it's okay. It's okay. I'm saying it's my own fault, and then I'm telling myself it's okay. I could just have this conversation with myself all lecture. Okay, so really, this is going to be the lecture where we meet all of the most important metrics in general relativity. I had time to just start at the end of last lecture, but it was a rush job, and so let's just start fresh. We want to introduce the maximally symmetric metrics. These we'll see are okay. They're important in their own right, just on purely geometrical grounds. But then in general relativity, they are the vacuum solutions of Einstein's equations. When t mu nu is equal to zero, but you just have a positive, negative, or zero cosmological constant, and they will also show up as the spatial sections that evolve with time in the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker in the FRW geometry that to a first approximation describes the universe that you live in. So that will be a good starting point to introduce in an easy way the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metrics. At the end, we'll say something about the black hole spacetime. Okay, so I will, because I did this last time, I will go a little bit faster through this initial bit. But so you remember the idea was that it's very convenient and also very good for visualizing these spaces, which otherwise are sort of hard to, it's, it, it can be hard to visualize their intrinsic geometry. It's much easier to visualize them embedded in a flat spacetime of higher dimensions, some surface embedded in a flat spacetime. And so to get the n-dimensional, so we want to construct the n-dimensional maximally symmetric space of signature p comma q. So in other words, with p space-like directions, p directions that contribute positively to the line element, and q time-like directions that contribute like time does negatively to the line element. And with curvature k, which can either be plus 1 if the space is positively curved, 0 if the space is flat, or minus 1 if the space is negatively curved. And we're going to do that just by generalizing the construction for the sort of standard construction for the metric on the n-sphere. So again, that construction goes as so that's the special case where the n-sphere is the special case where p comma q is n comma 0. In other words, the n-sphere just has only spatial dimensions, and k is equal to plus 1. It's a positively curved manifold. So that construction, we thought of it as we started with a space of one dimension higher, and so the line element was dx1 squared plus dot 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 plus dxn squared, and then we added an extra guy here, dx to the n plus 1 squared. And so this part in our notation would be more simply written as delta AB with lowercase indices, dxa, dxb. So my lowercase indices will run from 1 to n. And then this whole thing, including this extra xn plus 1 term, we would call delta sub ab, capital AB, where the capital letters run from 1 to n plus 1. They're the letters on the embedding space. And then the surface of the sphere is the surface in that n plus 1 dimensional space satisfying this equation. Okay, and now, in short, we're just going to get the general construction the with signature P, Q, and arbitrary curvature K by, first of all, everywhere we have a delta AB, we're going to make the replacement. Delta AB is replaced by the flat metric of signature P, comma Q. So I'll call that eta sub AB P, comma Q. And then I'll immediately start dropping the P, comma Q. I'll just ask you to remember that eta sub AB is, we're talking about the one with signature P, comma Q. So this is the diagonal metric, in other words, whose first P components have plus signs and whose next P components have minus signs. I mean, whose next Q components have minus signs. I should say they're just plus 1, plus 1, plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1. So just the generalization of the Minkowski metric, which would be an example of a metric with 3, comma 1 signature in this notation. So we'll make that replacement everywhere. And then we just have to insert a few factors of K. So basically, the new embedding space will have metric ds squared is equal to a to ab that's the n dimensional part, and then we're going to add an extra term to make it an n plus 1 dimensional line element, and whether this is an extra space like dimension or time like dimension depends on whether we're trying to get a space of positive curvature k equals plus 1, or negative curvature k equals minus 1. And then we, okay, and again, we'll call this whole thing eta capital AB. I mean, we'll call it eta AB dxA dx capital B. And then, the new definition of our surface, instead of this, will be generalized to the suitable modification, which is to replace delta capital AB to eta capital AB. And with a K here. Okay. And then we just do what we did before. The idea is now we have one equation which defines the surface. So really these n variables, the n plus 1 variables here are no longer independent. We can eliminate one. Let's eliminate x n plus 1. So if we solve this equation for x n plus 1, we have some equation like x n plus 1 squared is equal to rho squared minus K, and I will call it minus kx squared, where for convenience, let me introduce the notation that x squared is a to ab p comma q. It's the n dimensional. It's this. Yeah. Nope. Thank you very much. Okay, so when I solve this thing for xn plus 1, I get an equation like this. where I've introduced this. It's convenient to just define x squared to be this thing, the n-dimensional contraction of the coordinates. And then if I take the differential of this thing, I get dx n plus 1 is equal to minus k x sub a dx sub a over. So is it, if I differentiate this thing, I get 2 x sub n, x n plus 1 dx n plus 1, that's 0, and this is minus k, and then I get x1 dx1 plus x2 dx2 plus dot dot dot, which I'm writing this way in the numerator, and I've just divided both sides by x to the n plus 1, where I've introduced the notation here that x lower a, the other bit of convenient notation is x lower a is just defined to be lowered with respect to this Minkowski metric. So I take x with an up, whenever I see x with an upper index multiplied by eta in this fashion, I just define that to lower the index. And then x n plus 1, I can get rid of that using this equation. And finally, I just plug that all back in here. I just use this expression to eliminate all dependence in this metric on the n plus 1th coordinate. And I get okay, so this is it. This is a nice, convenient, unified expression for the metric on the maximally symmetric space of signature p comma q, p time-like direction, p space-like directions, q time-like directions, and curvature k. Written in what are usually called quasi-Cartesian coordinates. They're the basically Cartesian coordinates inherited from the embedding space. So let's see. One of the most useful things to do with this metric now. Well, let's start with the following. So a few things by way of intuition. Let's first draw some of these spaces. Okay, So we have our spaces labeled by k equals plus 1, k equals 0, and k equals minus 1. And these are n-dimensional spaces. They could have signature n comma 0, or n minus 1 comma 1, or n minus 2 comma 2, and so forth. And so the first two rows on this table are famous and important spaces that you really need to know about, no matter what you're going to do, probably. And so they all have names. This is the positively curved n-dimensional space is the n-sphere, and then this, of course, is just the Euclidean n-dimensional plane, and then this guy is the n-dimensional hyperboloid, or the n-dimensional hyperbolic plane, the uniform negatively curved space of n dimensions. So these curves are spaces. This row is spaces. This row is space-time. It has only one time direction. So the positively curved space-time in n dimensions is De Sitter space, n-dimensional De Sitter space. The one with zero curvature is n-dimensional Minkowski space, the n-dimensional setting for special relativity. And then anti-De Sitter space is the negatively curved space-time. Okay, and then usually you don't think about the rest of the rows here. For the various reasons, they haven't traditionally been as important in either mathematics or physics. In physics, maybe the notable thing to say is that one of the most concrete reasons that these things do show up from time in various places in the physics literature, maybe especially within the past 10 years or so, but anyway, they still don't play it. They still don't play a central role, although, who knows, things change. But one of the main things you have to deal with, if you have a space-time of signature something comma two, in other words, two time directions. Well, apart from the fact that you have to figure out how to make sense of, aside from pure mathematics, what it means to have two time directions. A basic problem is that normally on a space-time diagram, if this is a time direction and this is a space direction, and you physical particles, physical observables have to follow time-like curves, curves where, as you step along the curve, the element in ds squared is always less than or equal to zero. And so, you're confined. If you start here, you're confined to this upper light cone, and you can never move fast. You can never move faster than the speed of light, meaning you can never have your curve have a slope which is more shallow than the slope of the light curve here. So in particular, you're prohibited from doing something like this, going into the past and coming up and biting yourself by the fact that here, you'd have to be traveling superluminally at the top and bottom of this curve. But if these are both time directions, then there's no light cone here, and this is totally allowed. I mean, this is a time-like curve all the way, and so that's bad, I think. But maybe not so bad that there's not some way to figure out how to make sense of it. But anyway, it's something, that's the briefest way to say why these rows don't have names yet. So let's see. So let's draw some of these spaces. So the n sphere. Somehow you're just supposed to imagine the n-dimensional generalization of the two sphere. I can't do any better than that on the board. So that's all we'll say about that guy. And the n-dimensional plane, that one, I also can't really say anything helpful about how to visualize that space. Minkowski space has a light cone. That's the one. It's just the plane plus a light cone emerging from every point. So those guys. So we just want to say a few words about how to visualize these other three spaces, which are a bit harder to see intuitively. So let's start with the n-dimensional hyperbolic plane. So remember that in that case we took an n-dimensional space dx, we took an n-dimensional space with n space-like directions, and then we augmented it by k dx n plus 1 squared, so where k is minus 1, we're doing the hyperboloid, k equals minus 1. So in other words, we took an n-dimensional space, we added one time-like direction. So this is a space with signature n, comma 1. And the embedding surface here was supposed to be minus rho squared times, minus rho squared is equal to the n spatial directions minus, let's call this thing the time direction. Let's call this time-like direction t. So let's draw this n plus 1 dimensional space. Let me now convert this to an n plus 1 dimensional drawing where this is the time direction and these are sort of all of the other spatial directions. Okay, and so since it's a space-time, it has. Let's start by drawing the light cone here. And then, so what does the solution of this equation look like? Well, first start where x is equal to 0. And we have minus rho squared is equal to minus t squared. So in other words, we have these two points here are the solutions. So they're both separated. They're both separated by a distance rho. And then as we increase x, t has to get correspondingly bigger and bigger to keep the difference constant, to keep this equation satisfied. So this surface looks like this. Okay, it has two sheets. And let's make the light kind of three-dimensional while we're at it. As long as we're visualizing things, we ought to do it right. Okay, so this is what the n-dimensional hyperboloid looks like. You know, really it's just one of these two sheets. The embedding equation defines two sheets, but let's just throw that bottom one away. So this is you know, the picture you should intuitively have in mind when you think about the n-dimensional hyperboloid. It's this spatial sheet that asymptotes to the light cone in a Minkowski space of one dimension higher. So another while we have our n plus one dimensional Minkowski space drawn here, let's also talk about n-dimensional de Sitter space. N-dimensional de Sitter space. So here we started with so n-dimensional de Sitter space has signature p comma q is 3 comma 1. And then we added one spatial dimension. We added k dx n plus 1 squared, where k is positive now for de Sitter space. Okay, so this is again a space of signature n comma 1. So in other words, my same light cone, my same axes and light cone apply. But now what appeared on the left side of this equation was k rho squared. So now this is plus rho squared is equal to an equation like this. So now let's start at t equals 0. So the solution of this equation is a circle in the x direction of radius rho. I would love another color. Do you guys know where the colored chalk is lurking? Usually I'm not sophisticated enough to use colored chalk, but I'm going to make an exception. So we have a circle here of radius rho, and it, as we increase x now, as we increase t, we see we have to increase x correspondingly. The circle has to grow to keep this equation satisfied. So we have some surface like this, some hyperboloid, which again asymptotes to the light cone. And this is probably impossible to see. So that's the picture you should have of de Sitter space. And then anti-de Sitter space is similar, but it's so now if you went through the same thing, we have a metric with signature 3 comma 1 here for starters. Then we add another time-like direction. So the embedding space has two time directions here. And the surface is minus rho squared is equal to sum over n minus 1 spatial directions and minus 2 time directions here. So that's a space that, you know, it's a little bit less familiar to think about, but in other words, now, let's say this is one time direction. These are the various spatial directions. And then another time direction comes out of the board. In other words, this is the light cone now. And then the solution of this equation, if you think about it, so again, if we start at zero in the x direction, this equation is a circle in the T1, T2 plane of radius rho. So as you increase x, you find you have to correspondingly increase the radius of the circle. So in other words, anti de Sitter space looks like this. It's sort of de Sitter space flipped on its side or something. Okay, and I've also managed to get the front and back of my circle confused, but I hope it's hopefully, since this was just the last stage of the drawing, I didn't manage to confuse everybody about what it looks like. To me, it looks anyway. Okay, yeah. So I think this is maybe the most intuitive way to envision the actual geometry of these spaces. To understand the causal structure of the spaces is a different story. There, the best thing to use is the so-called Penrose, to draw the Penrose diagram of each space. But that's I will leave that to. I'm almost sure someone else is going to draw those. But in any case, I wasn't going to draw those here. Just to say that often it will be the case that you will be presented with one of these metrics in some particular coordinate system. And you want to know some question, you want to answer some question about the geometry, and your first impulse will be to somehow play around with that coordinate system. But very commonly, much more elegantly and simply, you can figure out the answer to your question by thinking of it in this form of in terms of the embedding in a higher flat space. But typically, if you are interested in some question about the causal structure, who can communicate with whom, what is some person's horizon, so forth. There your first impulse should not be to look at these things. It should be to derive the Penrose diagram for the space, or find the Penrose diagram for the space and work with that. Were any Penrose diagrams introduced in any course so far? One nod. Which was Neil? Okay, so let's see. While we're sort of talking about intuition about curved spaces, you've probably all seen this, but another thing just worth mentioning is that, so if you take, a positively curved space, so take the sphere, one thing to say about it is if you go out a radius r along the sphere and draw a circle, that circle is smaller than if you went out the same radius, if you went this same distance but straight. So in other words, in flat space, the circumference of a circle is 2 pi times its radius, and the area of the circle is pi times pi r squared. But you can see from this picture intuitively that the circumference and area are smaller, or in general the various volumes are smaller in a positively curved space for a given radius. And then the opposite is true in a negatively curved space. Everything is always opposite. All these rules of thumb are opposite in negatively curved spaces. Or another thing is, you've probably all seen this, but if you draw a triangle, for example, I can draw a triangle that goes like that, where every corner is a 90 degree angle on a positively curved surface. Generally speaking, if you live in a positively curved surface, you see that the straight lines, the geodesics in your space-time, they kind of want to curve together and cross, as opposed to in a flat space-time, where if they start off parallel like these two were supposed to have, they don't cross, and as opposed to in a negatively curved space-time, where if they start off parallel, they diverge from one another, or if they start off pointing towards one another in a negatively curved space-time, they diverge, but maybe they don't manage to get away from one another, and they cross, and so... So, in a positively curved space-time, you have triangles that are, you know, like this or like this, where their angles add up to more than 180 degrees. And in negatively curved spacetimes, you have triangles where their angles add up to less than 180 degrees. I don't know why I drew right angle signs on all of those. You know what I mean? Yeah, forget the right angle signs. I was just, sometimes I just like to make marks on the board. And they mean they're nonsense. Okay, yeah, I think maybe that was all I was going to say about visualizing these things. I just wanted to, on the homework, right before the lecture, I sent to Anna updated the first homework assignment and an updated version of today's lecture notes, which may or may not already be on the wiki. They are already on the wiki. So I was going to say that what we really want, the one final concrete thing we want about these maximally symmetric spacetimes that'll then be useful to us, we want to derive basically a very convenient formula about these spaces, and then see that they are indeed solutions of Einstein's equations in vacuum with a non-zero cosmological constant. So to do that, so we derived that the metric for the maximally symmetric space of signature P, Q and curvature K was given by the flat metric of that same signature, and then plus k times x lower a, x lower b over rho squared minus k x squared, where again, I remind you that I'm using this notation where x squared is defined to be the contraction of xa and xb with the flat metric. And x lower a is defined to be x upper b with its index lowered by the flat metric. So the first thing we need, there's a famous and extremely useful formula. The one equation we really want to extract from this section is a very simple, memorable formula that you will use again and again if you know it's there and remember it for the Riemann tensor for a maximally symmetric space. So in other words, given the metric, you can plug and chug and use the normal route to calculate the Riemann tensor, but in general, that's a huge pain. So for these spaces, it's very important to know that there is a simpler way to get the Riemann tensor just directly from the metric. So I ask you to derive that formula on the homework as the first homework problem. But I just want to sketch how the derivation goes to make sure that you don't. It shouldn't take very long, and so I just want to make. But I just want to explain how it goes. So you take the short route through. So we want to get there. We first want the inverse metric. With upper indices. And if you have a matrix and you want to know what its inverse matrix is, if you guess the answer and it's right, then that's the unique answer. That's true. That's true. Matrix inversion is unique. So I recommend not trying to explicitly invert this four, when you're checking this equation, explicitly invert this 4x4 matrix. That would be horrendous. Well, anyway, don't do that. Instead, I will give you a guess. And I just ask that you, or actually in this case, I'm just going to show you, just to show you how these manipulations go. Let's just check that it works, okay? Okay. So we want to check that G A B G GBC is equal to the unit matrix, delta AC. Okay, so GAB is this thing. GBC okay, so now let's just, so we have to multiply this out and get four terms. The first term, eta AB, eta BC, well, eta with upper indices is defined to be the inverse of eta with lower indices. And so that product gives me delta. So that's basically the term I want, and now I just want to show that the remaining three terms are zero. So the term for multiplying these two guys is that. In other words, this eta just lowers that index. The cross term for multiplying these two guys, all that happens is that this eta raises that index. Remember, it's nothing but the inverse of the eta that lowered its index originally. And then finally, these two terms. I should say, I'm always assuming that k is equal to plus or minus 1 here. The k equals 0 case, of course, we don't need to go through all this work. The k equals 0 case, the Christoffel symbols vanish, the Riemann tensor vanishes. So for k equals plus or minus 1, these two k's multiply to plus 1. There's that minus sign. This xa and this xc remain. These two xb's hit each other, and well, that's nothing but what we called x squared. Okay, so from here, it's just a matter of simple algebra to check that these three terms, every term has a common factor of xa, xc over rho squared. No, that's not true. Every term has a common factor of xa over xc, so you can factor that out of every term, and then it's just a question of checking that the remaining stuff, if you put it all over a common denominator, that the numerator vanishes. Oh yeah, k squared is 1, because I was saying I'm assuming it's minus or plus 1. So maybe I'll just do one more step, which is if we go through and calculate the Christoffel symbols using this formula, using the normal Christoffel formula. Okay, we want to find that it ends up having this simple form k xa over rho squared g, the full non-flat metric BC. So I'm not going to go through that whole calculation, although it's not long. It's just, but I'm going to leave that for the homework. I just want to say, for example, when you're calculating this derivative, the main thing I want to make sure is that what you're never doing is plugging in explicit values for any of these indices or anything like that. I just want to make sure it's clear that if you're doing that, you're making more trouble for yourself than you need to. So, for example, if I was going to show that this is equal to this, I would start by evaluating an expression for the first derivative of the metric. So let me just do that. GAB, comma C. Well, that's, so GAB is the Minkowski, the flat metric A to AB plus K X sub A X sub B over rho squared minus K X squared. Okay, and we want to take the derivative sub C. And now, so basically, for example, X sub X super A comma C, that would just be, that's the partial derivative of X of the X of the XA coordinate with respect to the XC coordinate. That's just a delta. So with that, it's easy to check that, you know, if you took the derivative of a guy with a lower index, that would give you an eta AC. Or for example, if you took the derivative of X squared, you know, if you took the derivative of X squared with respect to C, that's just 2x sub C, for example, because X is X upper A, X lower A. Anyway, these are good things. These are probably all the identities you need, along with, yeah. Once you're using this notation with eta to raise and lower the indices, once you're using this notation and these identities, you shouldn't need to ever do a lot of algebra or yeah.
The indices and not the full metric.
That's right. So it's just a matter of notational convenience here. It turns out to simplify all the algebra and make all the manipulations easier. So in other words, you're absolutely right that eta is not the full metric on the space. And so if you have some tensor on the space and you want to raise and lower its indices, you know, to convert it from an index from an object in the tangent bundle to an object in the whose index lives in the cotangent bundle, you need to use the full metric. This is just a notational trick, basically. It just makes for fewer terms at every step of the algebra, fewer factors, and so forth. Okay, so just to go one step further. So the partial derivative of eta, well, eta is just a diagonal matrix whose elements are ones and zeros and minus ones. So it vanishes. So the partial derivative acting on this, well, from acting on the numerator, we get a term like a to ac, xb, and another term like a to xa, a to bc, all over the denominator. And then from the derivative acting on the denominator, we get a term like okay, so you know that's as far as I'll go on the board. But so, for example, if you take that expression and plug it in with appropriate indices here, here, and here, you know the things simplify quite quickly to this form. So anyway, I just wanted to say I'm going to leave the derivations here to you. But the key point is to once you have this expression, you calculate. You know, you use this expression in turn for the that we had for the Ricci tensor, for the Riemann tensor. That it's gamma minus gamma comma something plus gamma gamma minus gamma gamma. And then you lower the index with a factor of you lower its index with a metric, and you find the formula that's really simple and worth remembering, which is so far we were using a particular coordinate system that happens to be convenient for deriving this. But once we get here, we have a tensor on the left-hand side, an expression involving purely tensors on the right-hand side. So now this is an equation you can just remember and apply in any coordinate system you want. It's just it's an actual geometric fact about these spaces that instead of having to go through all of this messy derivative business in the future, now that once you've checked it once in your life on your problem set, I hope you won't resent me for that. It's actually not very long. You have this much simpler way much simpler thing to work with, and so it's very, you know, you can track this thing with. Once you're here, it's a very short step to do all the other to calculate any other thing you want, like the Ricci tensor or the Riemann tensor or the Ricci scalar. And so, in particular, as you'll check on the homework, the Ricci tensor ends up being and the Ricci scalar, I guess, ends up being and so as a result, you Einstein's equations, which are G mu nu, so capital G mu nu, which is 1/2. So this is the Einstein tensor G mu nu plus lambda G mu nu is equal to 8 pi G Newton T mu nu. So the final thing to check in this section, the final thing to check on the homework problem, is just set T mu nu to zero. In other words, take a vacuum spacetime, an empty spacetime. If you just plug these two guys into this expression and choose the right value of lambda, this is a solution of Einstein's equations. And so what you end up getting from that exercise is a relationship between lambda and the radius of curvature of the spacetime. This rho that appears in all of these constructions. So the analog, so in all of these constructions, there's a rho, which in all of these spaces that have non-zero curvature, there's a characteristic radius of the space, a characteristic length scale. What is that? That's nothing. So what when you're checking the Einstein equations here, you find you have to put in a particular value of lambda, which is related to that length scale. In this way. So lambda. Yeah. So positively curved spacetimes. What am I trying to say? Well, the maximally symmetric spacetimes, you can get to them in two ways, is another way to say this. You can say nothing about Einstein's equations, nothing about gravity. You can just say, in geometry, what are the maximally symmetric spacetimes? What are the spacetimes with the largest maximal number of killing vectors, which I actually haven't introduced what a killing vector is, but anyway, it's this formal way of finding and counting the symmetries of a spacetime. And you arrive at these spaces, but the point is you can get at them another way. The laws of nature produce them as solutions when you have a non-zero, or when you have vacuum, they're the vacuum solutions of Einstein's dynamical laws for the universe. And when lambda, the cosmological constant, if it was positive, as it appears to be, as observations seem to indicate that it is today, then the vacuum solution is a positively curved, maximally symmetric space, De Sitter space. If lambda is negative, the solution is negatively curved, and so forth. So with that, having gone into so much effort understanding the maximally symmetric spacetimes, it's really very fast to introduce what the Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetimes are. They just correspond to spacetimes where you have a time direction, and at each moment in time, this is a maximally symmetric space. So this is either, so for example, in four-dimensional spacetime that we usually think of living in, we have a three-dimensional space here. And so this would, in the FRW spacetime, this would either be the three-dimensional Euclidean plane, the three-dimensional sphere, or the three-dimensional negatively curved hyperboloid. And then what we want is a space-time that at any given time it's symmetric like that, but as a function of time it can stretch or shrink in an arbitrary way. Okay? So that metric is just this guy. So here A of T describes how much things have stretched or squeezed as time goes by. So for example, if at time T equals 0, A of 0 is equal to 1, and at time T equals 1, A of 1 is equal to 2, that's saying the radius, this metric is saying that the space, let's say that k is plus 1, so at time t equals 0, the space at that time is a 3 sphere of radius rho, then at time t equals 1, that 3 sphere has just grown, the balloon has inflated, and is now of radius 2. Okay, its linear size has doubled. Again, I leave as an exercise the second problem on the homework is to go through, and the basic point here now is to take this metric. First of all, show that the inverse metric has these components: G00 is equal to minus 1, G0i and GI0 are 0. And Gij is equal to 1 over a squared times the inverse of this metric, which we derived in the previous section on maximally symmetric metrics. Okay, so again, the way you derive this is to take my guess as a present, as a late holiday gift to you guys, and check that it inverts the previous metric, and then use the fact that since it works, it's unique. So again, you know, same story as before. You can now derive the Christoffel symbols because the metric is so simple. The calculation, if you're doing it right, should be fast. It shouldn't be a big mess. The only thing to say is that you want to divide it into, with all these calculations, you just want to divide things according to spatial indices, which indices are spatial and which indices are time-like. But you never want to be differentiating between different time-like indices. So, you know, in other words, in this space, you need to calculate the Christoffel symbols for In principle, there are six types of Christoffel symbols you'd have to calculate, depending on which indices turn out to be zero. But again, you'll see the calculation is almost identical to the goes through very similar to the previous calculation for the maximally symmetric spaces. And you're checking the results that I give for these guys in the notes, which you'll see are very simple. And then you can go ahead and calculate the again simple and very and useful expressions for the various curvature tensors. And at the end of the day, what you want to do is plug into Einstein's equations, use the fact that the stress energy, let's do it. So it turns out we'll see next week, but for the sake of this problem, well, you can if you want to figure out why this is true, that's great. But for the sake of the problem set, you can take it as a given that the fact that the spatial the fact that the symmetry of the spacetime says that all of the spatial indices have to be the space is isotropic, all of the spatial indices are equivalent, but the time direction can be different. Means that when you put the stress energy tensor in this form where one index is up and one index is down, it has to be diagonal and all of the spatial components have to be equal. And they are defined to be the pressures. And the time-like diagonal component can also be non-zero. It's defined to be minus the energy density. And then all of the off-diagonal components are zero. Okay, so if you have given that expression for T mu nu, and after you take this metric and calculate the expressions for the Riemann tensor and Ricci tensor, so what you end up with is that the Einstein tensor is okay, and so the point is that there are really only two different components since all of the IJ components are since all of the IJ components are proportional to the since the IJ components are diagonal and the 0-0 component is the other non-vanishing component. There are really only two non-trivial Einstein equations. So if you plug this guy into g mu nu plus lambda g mu nu is equal to 8 pi g t mu nu with these expressions that you've derived for g and these guys, you'll find you just get two equations out. And those are again, two important equations that it's worth knowing. Although, yeah. Is A going to be? Oh, that's a good. Oh yeah, whoops. Thank you. Sorry, I forgot to say. So H is defined to be dA dt over A. So in other words, which is also usually written as A dot over A, or another way to write it is d of the log of A dt. So H is not a constant. H is just by definition A dot over A. Dot is standard in cosmology to mean d dt. Okay. So you get two equations out. And roughly speaking, those two equations are the 0-0 equation. Okay, so this is an equation that has h squared on the left side, the so-called Hubble expansion rate, the Hubble rate on the left side. And then it depends on how much energy density, how much spatial curvature, and how much cosmological constant there is on the right-hand side. So this equation is called the Friedmann equation. It's one of the, let's say, two most basic equations in cosmology, and it says when the universe is homogeneous, it tells you, well, depending on how much matter, cosmological constant, or vacuum energy, and curvature you have, the space wants to expand at different rates. So this is the equation that tells you how the geometry responds to the matter that is present, or vacuum energy that is present. And then the other equation is the so-called continuity equation. Oh, whoops. Let's write the n-dimensional version. So this guy, rho dot is equal to minus n h rho plus p, is the so-called continuity equation. So it's the opposite. It's saying how the matter responds to the expansion of the space-time. As the space-time expands, because h is non-zero, h being positive means that the space-time is expanding. H being negative would mean that the space-time is contracting. So if h is positive and rho plus p is positive, this equation is saying that as the universe expands, rho, the energy density, dilutes. Rho dot is negative. And it tells you, you know, how fast the density goes down as a function of how fast the space is expanding and what the equation of state is for the matter, what the relationship is between rho and p in that space-time. Okay, so these are really important. These are like the two most important equations in cosmology, the Friedmann equation and the continuity equation. I should say the continuity equation is called that because it really can be, it really can be derived in another way. Well, the way I just expressed it was that you'll find that there's really only two non-trivial Einstein equations. The 0-0 component and the II components. But alternatively, we can say, well, if we take the covariant derivative of this side, then it turns out that the covariant derivative of this always vanishes, and the covariant derivative of the metric also always vanishes. So the covariant derivative of t mu nu also, what I said was wrong. If we take the covariant derivative in this way, okay, what I'm trying to say is that, I'm making a hash of it, but what I'm trying to say is, if you take the covariant derivative of t mu, let's write it this way. T mu nu covariant derivative nu, so these two indices are contracted. This thing has to vanish. There's various ways to see that it has to vanish. One way that I was saying is that, well, these two sides have to be equal, and the Bianchi identities force the corresponding derivative of this guy to vanish, and we chose the connection precisely so that the covariant derivative of this guy would always vanish. But anyway, this is called the equation for the local conservation of stress energy. And the zeros, the mu equals zero component of this equation is also just this equation. So the mu equals zero component is saying that, roughly speaking, you know, if the energy density in a little box goes down, it has to be flowing out through the edges of the box or pushing on the edges of the box. It doesn't quite say that because the relevant object in So it says this. What it really precisely says is this, but so this is the idea. It's the analog of in electromagnetism when you have an equation that says, you know, that the decrease of charge in a little infinitesimal box has to be equal to the amount of charge current that's flowing out through the walls of that box. In other words, charge isn't created or destroyed. This is the analog in a homogeneous space-time for the energy density. Okay, so that's it. I will there's a if you In the notes, I've included a final section on black holes, on spinning and non-spinning black holes. I just leave that if you're interested. I recommend reading about them. They're, especially the spinning black holes, are awesome. Maybe I'll just say one thing about spinning black holes, which is that you will almost always in courses encounter them written in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. And those are the coordinates that make a spinning black hole. Those are kind of the most useful coordinates for doing astrophysical calculations, if you want to calculate, you know, what an observer will see around a black hole and so forth. They're usually done in these Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. I just want to say those obscure the, there are these other coordinates called Kirchhoff coordinates, which I explain in the notes. And there, you know, these make the astrophysics less clear, but they bring out the what is special about the metric much more transparently. So these are somehow the coordinates that you want to see the Kerr metric at least once in these coordinates in your life. And So we've finally managed to introduce the Friedmann equation and the continuity equation, and actually have the metric and the basic zeroth order equations that we'll need for the rest of the course. So in the first lecture of next week, the idea is to get to know this metric, understand how particles, massive and massless particles, move in it, how it responds to the presence of matter in more detail. And then once we've gotten to know it a little bit, then the rest of the course is about understanding how, well, for the most part, it's about understanding the sort of interaction in the early universe between the expansion of the universe and various things in particle physics, and so what we can learn about the early universe, what we know about the early universe based on present day observations, the interaction between the early universe and what we do and don't know about the standard model of particle physics, and what comes beyond the standard model of particle physics, and so forth. But so anyway, so the geometrical part of the course is almost done, and then starting hopefully Tuesday, the rest of the course will get in a way to more of the physics of how the actual matter living in that geometry comes to be in the state that it's in, what we do and don't know about it, what the mysteries are. So that's it.